Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the largest segment of society. To those of you who have come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt. They're not trustworthy. In fact, they're actually counterproductive. And they cannot be fixed. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is 877-300-7645. Since the big item in Washington seems to be the condition of our borders and the fact that children are being sent by parents across, I put parents in air quotes, you probably couldn't see that, those of you listening on the radio, across the border, unaccompanied by the tens of thousands, I thought I'd share with you a story that is published in the Los Angeles Times. It reads, Going on Faith. Santo Toribio is seen as a shepherd to border crossers, his statue now touring the South land draws thongs. The story reads, People say he's their guardian. Others say he's their lawyer, their smuggler. On a recent afternoon, they lined up at his feet with their requests. By the tens of thousands, mind you. One said, Please, my mother needs a visa. Please, my niece was caught by the agents. Please, I can't go on continuing to be illegal. As a border crisis involving the influx of tens of thousands of children from Central America continues to unfold, the faithful, these would be Roman Catholics, of Southern California are flocking by the tens of thousands to Santo Toribio Romo Gonzalez. Oh, he must be one heck of a guy, don't you think? Well, actually, he's dead. The Catholic saint, whom they believe watches over immigrants, flew in for the first visit to Los Angeles last weekend. He came in a tiny box from the tiny town in the Mexican state of Jalisco. In the form of a fragile wooden statue that will tour Roman Catholic churches across three counties. So it's not only that Roman Catholics have been duped into believing that a dead man now masquerading as an idol, as a icon, as a religious symbol, is their shepherd, is their lawyer, can hear them, can answer their prayers, but the Roman Catholic Church is playing right along. The Roman Catholic Church canonized him. The Roman Catholic Church paid to have him brought up for the adoring throngs of misguided nincompoops. The Roman Catholic Church will have this religious icon, this idol, placed inside of their sanctuaries. You know, in the Roman Catholic Church, you can't say, you know his name. But you can sure as hell disregard the second of three instructions that he etched on the first of the two tablets that he offered to humankind. Idols are just fine in Roman Catholicism. This story continues. It cost the price of two first-class tickets to get him here. But we did it, said Rosa Gonzalez of Chatsworth, who handled the saint's transportation. You'd think if he was a saint, he could fly. You'd think if he was a saint, he'd be able to handle his own transportation. Oh, but no, the faithful had to buy him two first-class tickets. She said, now he's here, bringing blessings to everyone, end quote. You know, religion is clearly for the stupid. Ms. Gonzalez, you are an absolute idiot. Gosh, it's just amazing what people will fall for. Romeo Gonzalez was a simple priest. He was killed during a religious uprising in 1928. If he couldn't protect his own life when he was alive, how is he protecting your life, idiot Catholic, now that he's dead? This happened in 1928. He was canonized, which means he was made a saint, by the Roman Catholic Church just 14 years ago, all in conflict with Yahweh's testimony, where it said, you ought not speak for, you ought not speak to the dead. But Latinos, particularly Mexicanos, have made him legendary. They say that the saint, often wearing a cowboy hat and boots, I wonder if he chooses his own apparel, miraculously appears to border crossers when they are most desperate in the desert along roadsides. Excuse me as I turn the page, moving from the front page of the Los Angeles Times in the Sunday edition, this prior Sunday. Yes, you can get your religion right on the front page of the LA Times. Also in migrant shelters. Yes, but he can't make his way from Mexico to the United States on his own, not without two first-class tickets. Santo Toribio gives them food. Oh, I bet he does. He gives them money and water. But like a coyote or smuggler, he helps them cross into the United States and then disappears. Sometimes when the path is too perilous, he tells them to turn around and to return home. Yeah. Isn't he special? Quote, I owe him everything, said Jose Ochoa, the idiot, who showed up to welcome the saint to his church. This is the Santiago de Compostela in Lake Forest. Quote, I couldn't imagine dying without coming to see him, to tell him, thank you. I just tell you, you know, you should have no pity for a Roman Catholic. I mean, just should have no pity. And imagine that these are the morons that are now flooding into America and controlling elections. Yes, they vote as a bloc. And their votes are so overwhelming as a bloc that there is absolutely no way now to get anyone who is opposed to letting more Roman Catholic morons like this cross the border. Now, you might say, oh, you're being unkind. What harm is there for people to put their faith, their hope in something that, you know, gives them hope? Because it's pure lunacy, because it's directly opposed to God's instruction, because it has no merit whatsoever. And offering false hope is one of the most merciless things a person can do. There's more on this story, but we have Glenn having called into in from Philadelphia. I bet, Glenn, you have a comment on the great saint of the migrants. Hello, Glenn. Are you there, my friend? We don't seem to be able to have Glenn. We'll hope that he'll be able to chime in. He seems to be locked in on the switchboard, but we'll await his voice. I'll continue with the story. The 32-year-old cook crossed the border illegally in 2005.
Hello.
Hello there, Glenn.
Hello. Yes, I've been talking right along.
Yeah, Glenn, your quality of the voice is so bad.
How's that? Any better?
That's a little better.
Okay, should be. I don't know what happened there. It's wasn't me. I wasn't on mute. Okay. I'm sitting here going, hello.
Anyway, there
you go. What I was saying is, Andre, Eva, this is a Jeffers, Speedy Gonzalez. Yeah. He's got to be speedy because you run around listening to all those tens of thousands of prayers. He doesn't have to be quite as fast as Santa Claus, though, because, you know, it's a lot to grow on here.
It has to be as mythical as Santa Claus. You know, it's amazing that the front page of the L.A. Times shows thousands of people trying to touch him. They want to touch him in his lower extremities. I think it's somewhere below the waist because allegedly there's one of the bones of this dead fellow that is has been used to make the idol.
Oh, okay. Well, that's, I don't know, it's kind of hands around the extremities. That's kind of a massive ring to it to me. But anyway, what's so reprehensible about this is that, you know, the Pope goes along pushing the mythology, and obviously the saint has no regard for the law, you know.
No.
I mean, Jesus, you know, Yahusha, you know, encouraged his disciples not to run afoul of the law unnecessarily, you know.
Yeah, his comments were basically given to Rome that which is Roman,
which is
and you
Rome.
And he was not telling you, don't run afoul of the law. That was really Paul that Romans.
Go around deliberately defying, or Yahusha didn't go around deliberately defying.
That, of course, is a huge extrapolation from the give unto Caesar that which is Caesar, because all he was talking about there is we're the great grievance in Israel at the time was that like all of Rome's provinces, the Romans tacked their citizens to death. And the Jews didn't like paying the tax to Rome, so they wanted their Messiah to be a warrior who would fight Rome and free them from being a vassal, having to pay egregious taxes. And he looked at the Roman coin and said, "This has nothing to do with me. Why don't you just give to the Romans that which is theirs? This has nothing to do with me."
Well,
but he never said that we should comply with governments or give any homage to governments. His view was pay attention to the Torah, learn from it. We'll be back with Glenn and this conversation in a moment. Chattering Miss. Glenn, the point that you made was valid in the sense that the Roman Catholic saint, as he's being presented to the Roman Catholic faithful, is, of course, encouraging the Roman Catholic faithful to act illegally and to disregard national laws, and in that regard, that's a valid statement. I would agree.
We know that Yahweh cannot lie, and that certainly Yahusha in his life on earth didn't run afoul of even the Roman authorities. It wasn't the Romans who went to the Jews and said, "Hey, this guy of yours is a problem." It was the Pharisees.
I want to be really clear on this. In the seventh and eighth chapters of Daniel, which of course the ninth chapter is the one that sets the timing of the arrival of Yahusha in Jerusalem. Yahweh, who is Yahusha? Yahusha is simply diminished manifestation of Yahweh, the mouth of Yahweh. Yahweh said things that would have been the extreme of running afoul with Rome. He said that Rome was the worst country in human history, and that that it was barbarian, that it was butcherous, that it was corrupt. I mean, he went on and on to describe his literal hatred for everything Roman. Roman Empire and Roman Catholic Church. And Yahusha's open letters in Revelation, the second, third, and fourth, and perhaps even the first, if you recognize who the false apostle is, was the Roman Paul, are all established to say that the Roman Catholic Church is the seed of Satan. It's married to Lord Baal, which is Satan, and that it is dead. So, you know, it's it would be a stretch to say that he was accommodating of Rome. The fact of the matter is, while he was here, Rome was not of interest to him. While he was here, he was here for a singular purpose, which was to be the living manifestation of the Torah and for Yahweh to fulfill the first four mikra so that he could honor his promises regarding the covenant. So Rome was not of interest to Yahusha during his 3-year mission, if you will, in 33 CE. Ending in 33 CE.
But in a more general sense, Yahweh cannot lie. And Yahusha, you know, is presented to us as a living truth. So encouraging people to surreptitiously transgress, you know, the borders of another nation is not exactly an activity of truth seekers and truth doers.
No, Yeah, you know, we are asked to walk away from our country, and that's why I constantly say walking away from your country has nothing to do. Yeah, it has nothing. Yeah, that's why I keep on saying it doesn't mean you walk from Mexico to the United States or from the United States to the Bahamas. Good luck walking from one to the other in that case. But what it does mean is you disassociate from your country in terms of your allegiance to them. You stop voting. You stop participating in politics. And you disassociate yourself from religion. It is truly astonishing. I mean, when you see how many people, and this story goes on and on and on. I mean, this story that the majority of the children who are sent by their parents to cross the border illegally, which is a very dangerous thing to do, they're sent with a picture of this saint in their wallet or pocket, and it's been plasticized, you know, laminated, one of those laminations. So they buy it from the Roman Catholic Church, all plasticized and laminated, and they tell their child that if they have faith in this little plastic card image of the religious icon, the whole crossing will go so splendidly for them.
You may remember the 60s pop song on the radio. I don't care if it rains or freezes, because I got my plastic Jesus riding on the dashboard of my car.
Yeah, it's like the Carrie Underwood, Got Jesus at the Wheel. Yep. Folks, you've been beguiled. But, you know, the good news is, Glenn, as we consider the Gallup poll, the majority of Americans, 55% of those in America, recognize that religion is unreliable, that they are lying to you. Moving on to a different part of the world, equally screwed up by religion, we find Dateline Baghdad. The dangerous struggle between the leadership of Iraq and the country's Kurdish minority intensified the end of last week, as the Kurds seized two oil production facilities in the Kirkuk province, and the prime minister announced that he was appointing a temporary replacement for the prime minister, who is a puppet of the government. A Shiite, the prime minister, that was a foreign minister, I should say, that was going to be replaced. The prime minister, of course, we know is al-Maliki. He moved to replace the current foreign minister, who is a Kurd, with a Shiite. That's the way to be inclusive, I guess. Maliki was responding to a decision by Mr. Zebari and other Kurdish cabinet members. Now, the Kurds have completely walked out of the legislature. They want nothing to do with Iraq. They are actually declaring their independence from Iraq. And they're boycotting all cabinet meetings and all government meetings. In a television address on the end of last week, Maliki charged that the Kurds were harboring Sunni militant opponents of the central government, and were even allowing members of the group known as the Islamic State, which slept through northern Iraq to reorganize operations in Kurdistan. Now, Glenn, as I share that with you, there's probably a number of things that strike you. One is that it's obvious that the Shiite government of Iraq, rather than becoming more inclusive, is becoming less inclusive. Second, that Malaki is stoned out of his mind. Up to this point, the only militia that has been successful in opposing the Islamic State has been the Kurds. Rather than harboring Sunni Muslims, rather than working with the Islamic State, they've been vicious opponents. As a matter of fact, after having battled the Kurds on a few occasions, ISIS won't even go, which is now just is, won't even go near them. So we're moving toward a complete breakup of the country, and we have absolutely delusional leaders at the helm of this country, all because of what the United States has done.
Well, right, absolutely. And, well, it's pretty obvious that given the rabid nature of this Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, I mean, when it's, you know, obviously by changing name from ISIS to IS, he obviously plans to, that's his statement of his intent to bring about the larger caliphate. So the Kurds and the Iranians have no choice. The other Shiites have no choice. I mean, if he did say the full out assault on the Kurds, Iran would be in there with their al-Quds forces overnight. You know, they have no choice but to ally against him. And this could be the beginning of what you talked about weeks ago, where the eventual, ascendance to dominance of the Sunnis would seem inevitable just based on numbers alone.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way of putting this current fight off and push it off into the sidelines. I don't think that this one can be resolved ever. Now is a fight to the death between Sunni and Shia Islam, that the only possibility for marginalizing it over the next few years will be the infighting between, for example, the IS and Ibrahim, its leader, is scoffing at Muslims for their pilgrimage to Mecca, just so that they can circumambulate and touch stones and relics. And he says, you've completely lost track of who Allah really is, and therefore he wants to go and control Mecca. The Sa'ads, they don't want that. And so you've got the Sa'ads putting their troops on the border, wanting to prevent IS from being there, but also wanting to prevent the Shia in Iraq from advancing.
Right.
And so,
is this guy megalomaniacal enough in his aspirations for to become the caliph that he's going to presume to parentally chastise both the Shiites and the Sunnis in taking over the whole enchilada?
Yeah, what's really interesting here is that thus far we've had about somewhere between 10% and 20% of the million-strong army that America paid $25 billion to establish and equip lay down their arms. And thus far we have seen the Shiite militia that have been put up against the Sunni militias of IS be utterly destroyed. So at this point, IS, with billions of dollars of captured U.S. weaponry and several billion dollars in wealth and an alliance with the Sunni warlords that were part of the American Awakening program, cannot be stopped in Iraq either by the Shiite government army or the Shiite militias. And it does not appear that that Ibrahim is interested in consolidating his gains. He seems as devoted to world conquest as was Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should assume that IS, the Islamic State is going to invade Jordan, where they will find the refugees that call themselves Palestinians extraordinarily supportive.
Right, they're all over like a trained poodle. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And they will, there are many of the people living in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia that also will find them acceptable. And so will many of the Turks. So it's hard to see how this ends in a favorable way. Then you've got the issue of the fact that the Sunni outgun and outman Shia Muslims, and they've been at war with each other for 1,400 years. That's not going to get resolved. Right now, they're trying to bring it to a head, and the stated goal is to rid the world initially of Shia Islam. I mean, that is the Islamic State's primary ambition. Has nothing to do with, you know, the old Al-Qaeda mindset of let's go kill the great Satan because the great Satan is infecting the lands of the Muslims. They wanted to attack Americans, the great Satan, because we had a troop presence in Saudi Arabia, for example, the world of Islam, and we were infecting it. Well, that's not the Islamic State's mission at all. Not even remotely. They have no interest in that. Their interest is ridding the world of Shia Muslims.
Well, they can always go back to that later. You know, they could, once they can turn their sights back to the Western influence later on as being a great state, but then maybe they decided to finish off the internecine rivalry, first, because to be divided is to be conquered. So when you get rid of the division, then they'll have, you know, if he gets his caliphate well underway, say he could, you know, displace the Assad in Syria, and he could displace mullahs in Iran. Then he can turn his sights back to vilifying the West.
The other thing that's kind of interesting is that with Al-Qaeda, even at its peak 10 to 25 years ago, Al-Qaeda never had a system of governance. They never tried to assimilate territory, never once. And yet the Islamic State is not only able to assimilate great swaths of territory. I mean, they now control most of Syria and most of Iraq, and they're going to expand well beyond that. They have governmental systems in place. Now, they're draconian, but they're able to run their books and accumulate monies and be financially successful. They've accumulated enormous amounts of weaponry. They've accumulated and are governing huge swaths of territory. And so this is really is a formidable foe. And it does not appear that the Shiites are capable of repelling them.
So they understand that the pen is mightier than the sword when the pen is manipulating numbers, actually.
Both
the sword and the pen going for them.
Yeah, and what they're all doing, too, is fighting to control the oil fields. Because in the world of Islam, there is no economic prosperity. There is no source of revenue. There's nothing apart from the black ooze. If you were to take black ooze away from them, they would all be bankrupt instantaneously. And so they're all fighting for control of the oil fields. Recently, Malaki tried to use the Kurds to protect an oil field from IS, and what the Kurds did is they took the oil field for themselves. So, this is a battle being waged in a very new and different way. And there does not appear to be any resolution to this. I think it is a fight to the death.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Sauds and the Emirates, they're going to be extremely threatened by him at some point.
What's interesting is that at this point, the largest supporter of the Islamic State is Qatar. They have supplied the weapons that the Islamic State is deploying. They want Iran and Shiite Islam eradicated. And the fact is, the second largest supplier of weapons to the Islamic State is Saudi Arabia. They also want Iran and Shiite Islam controlled. And so this the big message you have here, not only is this Islam against Islam, but you you have the United States arming both sides and then trying to pick a fight between both sides once it's armed both sides. But you've got every country.
But the OPEC nations, the Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar and stuff, United Arab Emirates, they don't realize, I don't think yet, just exactly kind of monster they're creating. Where they're just, right now they're going, it's alive, and it hasn't turned on them just yet.
Yeah, it's very much like them fueling Islamic terrorist rage to attack and influence the world, but not wanting any of those fundamentalist Muslims to influence Saudi Arabia. And the reason is that the Saudi Arabians do not want to lose power to anyone. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Saturday Mess. One of the things that is surprising, at least was surprising to me, about the Islamic State's overwhelming success in Syria and in Iraq is the fact that, according to the United Nations, only about 2,500 people are dying in this conflict a month. Now, 2,500 people, a lot of people, but if you consider the number of people that the Muslims were killing just in tit-for-tat suicide bombings every month, it's not a lot different than what Iraq has experienced over the last 10 years since the U.S. invasion in suicide bombing. So, about 2,500 people are dying a month, most of them Shiite Muslims trying to, and militias trying to defend their holy shrines. Surprising. I would tell you that, we still have Glenn on the line, I would tell you that, that there is one potential solution to the Islamic State. And when I'm going to share this with you in terms of the solution, it won't fly because of the egos involved. But if Assad were allowed to have a Syria that included all of southwestern Syria, the area around Damascus, which has a majority Shia religiously, and that's really the only part of Syria that he controls at this moment, is the southwestern corner. He's allowed to keep that. The Islamic State is allowed to keep the rest of Syria and all of western Iraq. And that's a Sunni enclave. And then southeastern Iraq, which is mostly Shia, would be annexed into Iran. And then in northern Iraq, also including small portions of eastern Turkey and northern Iran, where the Kurds are the majority ethnically, that would be its own country, and separate them. Now, of course, the United States is pushing for exactly the opposite. Europe is pushing for exactly the opposite, which has no chance of success. Iran wants to maintain absolute Shia control over Iraq. And Assad wants to gain his whole country back. And Saudi Arabians and the Turks want to eliminate the increase of power that the Iranian Shiites now have as a result of America's invasion of Iraq. So the egos involved, I don't think, would allow that. As a matter of fact, whoever's the head of the of al-Nusra in Syria would probably oppose the Islamic State and their fellow Sunnis. And ultimately, when the Islamic State settles in the Sunni territories in western Iraq, the Ba'athists, the former Ba'athists and elite under Saddam Hussein, will be vesting for control and wrestling for control. So while it well, that's the only potential for moderation, I don't think the egos involved will allow it. And there's too many American weapons at the hands of these various egos for it to occur. What do you think, Glenn? Now, we still have Glenn on the line, but difficulty technically. I want to move to another. Go ahead, Glenn.
It's this.
Oh, well, we had a hello from Glenn, and then that was it.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Glenn. Go ahead.
I think it's on urine. It's something in, I'm not doing anything. But anyway, the only way to do that it would be with an iron-fisted dictator like Saddam Hussein or something. Certainly not the bureaucracy of the UN isn't going to be able to enforce what you were talking about.
Well, you've got an iron-fisted dictator in Damascus. I don't think there's...
He's pretty cerebral for an iron-fisted dictator.
No, he's pretty murderous. His whole family has been murderous. Yeah. You know, they killed, you know, 30,000 people in a day. The last time they played the Sunni versus Shia game. So he's pretty iron-fisted, and
okay.
I don't see much equivocation or moderation with the Caliph Ibrahim. You certainly don't see much equivocation or moderation from the mullahs in Iran. I mean, I think you've got iron-fisted dictators. For the Kurds, they are the most unified, the most intolerant of any of these people because they've been abused for centuries, and this is their last and greatest hope. So I think you've got people who are sufficiently maniacal on all sides. We'll be back after the news.